Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution, the Michigan Progressive Podcast. I'm your host, Liano Sharon. Today, my guests are Nicholas Jansen and Shelby Crone, both organizers with the Sunrise Movement here in Michigan, as well as Andrew Nowicki, a local activist, a naturalist, and environmental educator. So I'd like to start with Shelby and Nicholas. If you could tell me a little bit about, in the audience, a little bit about the Sunrise Movement and how you guys came to be working with Ocasio-Cortez on this Green New Deal that's being talked about across Washington now.
Yeah. So Sunrise, we're an army of young people working to stop climate change and create millions of jobs in the process. And so this is our new group, started a year and a half ago, and we just ended a big phase where we had Sunrise Semester. We're across the country. We were organized in five key states to get candidates elected that prioritize climate change, aren't accepting any fossil fuel money, and will really do what we need to really tackle climate change. And so we don't know the exact intricacies of how the relationship with AOC came to be, because that was with some of our other staff. But essentially, we knew Alexandria was campaigning on a Green New Deal, and this was a big proponent of what she was working on. She took our No Fossil Fuel Money pledge. She was one of our early adopters of the pledge, so we were happy to have her on board there. We were campaigning for her in New York. And so as we were like thinking, how can we make this a reality? How can we make this a platform? We knew Alexandria had a lot of media attention around her, has a lot of respect and just poise about her. And so our campaign, our staff reached out to her staff to see if we can do anything about it. A resolution was written jointly by our group and her staff, and we coordinated this action in D.C. on November 13th, a week after the election, and to just really put it out there and let people know now's the time.
Sure. So, what, Shelby, can you go into what is the Green New Deal and how is it and how is this supposed to work?
Yeah, the Green New Deal essentially is going to transition us to 100% renewable energy in the next 10 years, and it's going to provide many, many people with jobs, and it's going to fight racial injustice, environmental injustice. And just working with unions is so important. You just really need to boost our infrastructure to like fix climate change. And this is the only policy like on a big enough scale to actually fight this crisis.
So, how is that going to work? I mean, what's the plan for making that happen? So what I've seen so far is there's a draft for a select committee in the House of Representatives. And as I understand it, what the, let me tell you how I understand and see if that makes sense to you. What it looks to me like to put it in a summary form is, we recognize that the planet's climate is in crisis. And we have, according to our own research organizations, about 12 years, they said, to make some significant changes in the way that we produce energy and go about living our lives, really, from industrial production to, you know, home power use. We have about 12 years to fix, to change how we do all of that, to prevent a temperature rise that will be devastating to billions of people. And given that situation, we need to have a plan for how to transition a large economy, for example, of the United States, where we would need to duplicate this in other countries around the world as a species if we're going to actually avoid the climate catastrophe that the newest reports are telling us that we're headed for. And so this is the idea of the Select Committee is to use the resources of the of our legislature to bring together the people who have the technical expertise in all of the different fields necessary to create a plan and put together the legislation that would actually implement that plan and to have that ready to go in 2020, basically 2 years from now. So that gives us 10 years to implement it according to the timeline that the best science we have, that a report that just came out a week or two ago is telling us. And the other side of that, because the one side of that is, okay, we got to do all of these changes, but the other side of that, when you're talking about jobs, when you're talking about racial justice, when you're talking about other issues like that, bringing in unions, et cetera, the other side of that is, this, you know, if we're going to do this, it means that the government is going to spend an awful lot of money. And so we want to make sure that we're not just feeding more money into just the wealthy. We want to make sure that when we solve this big climate problem that's been created, I would argue, by capitalism, that we don't exacerbate the problems of the problems concentrated wealth and power that the capitalist system has led to that's produced this problem in the first place. Is that a good summary of what's trying to be accomplished here?
Yeah, so you hit the nail on the head there.
Okay, so reading through the draft legislation, there's still a lot of stuff to be worked out. Are there any particular areas that you think are going to be especially contentious that we need that might not be immediately obvious, or where do you think you're going to get the most pushback from?
That's a great question. A big part of it that people always bring up is like, well, how are you going to pay for this and everything? And that's still being worked out. I don't know the exact intricacies of that, but basically the way we see it is if we have the money to give tax breaks to the richest in this country, if we have the ability to increase our military budget by $87 billion when we already spent more than the rest of the country combined, we can allot the money for this, and it'll release also free up money from other social programs that are already in place, like food stamps and stuff, because ideally that stuff won't be needed. So we always hear, oh, well, where are you going to get the money? And as many people point out, that's where we're going to get it. It's just what we're going to prioritize with the money. So.
Andrew, you've been an environmental activist for a long time, and this is obviously going to have a huge effect on the environment, both in terms of whatever the positive effects of it are, but there's also there's also questions about looking after the effects created by this shift, where you're taking where you have to have a lot of production of new kinds of equipment, new kinds of like, for example, the energy grid is one of the key things that it says. So there's a lot of there's a lot of manufacturing that has to go into this. There's a lot of construction that's going to have to happen, for example, in the transportation sector. Do you have any particular concerns about how that's looked at, or what are some of the things that we should be looking at that we should at a high level that should be considered when we're looking at building this plant?
So I think with a lot of environmental issues, it's important to recognize that a lot of the things that we view as obstacles are actually things that are trying to solve different problems. Mm-hmm. So transportation, we have oil and we have all these fossil fuels that are doing something for us. Mm-hmm. And if we transition to renewable energy, we still have to do that thing. Mm-hmm. We just have to do it a different way. Mm-hmm. And with an issue, especially like climate change, that's mm-hmm. as big as this, I think it's also important to realize that this isn't something that just the individual can do. This isn't something that I can decide, I'm going to make my house 100% renewable energy, mm-hmm. and that's going to stop climate change. It'd be great if I did, and it would help, but this isn't all-in or nothing. If we don't all band together and do this, mm-hmm. then it will not happen. And I think the obstacles with transportation mm-hmm. can be solved. The technology is there. It's just a matter of putting it together.
So, and for example, what kind of technologies do you think that's going to require from what we know today?
It would require renewable energy, and not from a single source. We'd have to use multiple sources of renewables. Okay. So solar grids and wind energy, hydro energy, all these different methods of producing energy have drawbacks. They all have consequences to them. Mm-hmm. And so you need a mixture of everything in order to make it work. And I think a committee would be in a better place to find out the technical details for that.
Sure. I was wondering about transportation because you just mentioned that. Was there any particular technologies that you think we should be looking at for transportation there?
Electric cars.
Okay.
Subways and trains that we don't have would be pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
So public transportation in general, is that something that you think has to be on the table, or is that, because one of the things that always comes up about this kind of stuff when we talk about high speed rail, and this is for everyone, not just Andrew, is people say, well, I like driving my own car, I like the individual part, the individualist part of that, and so I don't necessarily want to have a train where I have to go and be on the train with a whole bunch of other people. Now, everywhere in the world where those things exist, people, adapt to that. And a lot of people, most people in those in Europe where they have good public transportation, or Asia where they have good public transportation, people like that. And sometimes it's even even seen as better than individual transportation, even for the individual. But sometimes they also have congestion and that and so on. So that's a cultural shift that we're talking about making. Has Sunrise talked about that kind of cultural shift? Did that make sense?
Yeah, Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know. I think at least for me, when I think about transportation, I like to think about the people who don't have their own vehicle and for who this would be like a huge asset for them.
Sure.
Like this would be a great opportunity for us to like come together and, you know, support public transit that's accessible to everyone and not just like the individual, individualized cars that aren't necessarily affordable or good for the environment.
Right. So, I agree. I mean, there's the complaint. Well, I like to have my own car and have the freedom is what people say, to get on the road. The way that actually the automotive industry sold cars to the U.S. for decades has been the freedom of the open road. You know, the whole ethos of Route 66 and that kind of stuff. That's been an iconic American cultural ideal in a certain sense for a long time. But that's also a very privileged position for people that can afford to have a car and can afford to go and drive 1,000 miles of Route 66, for example, and not have to worry about, their job or, their income or paying the, et cetera. But what's happened is a lot of the time those people with those kinds of privileges are the people that are making the decisions or electing the people that make the decisions in our system or funding their campaigns, et cetera, even on relatively small scales. I would recommend, in my opinion, this cultural shift is something that we have to address in order for this to move forward. It's not just a question of technology. It's a question of how technology affects individuals and their perception of their relationship to society and how that impacts their lifestyle. Has there been any discussion about that yet? Is that something that people are interested in? Or
That's a great question and point. And any change on the scale we're talking about is going to be pushback, and it's going to take time to get people on board. And the strategy we've been having moving forward is we not only need to build political power, but we need to build people power, and then we also need to align various movements around the country, around everything. And that's a lot of work, and that's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight.
Sure.
But like you all were mentioning earlier, Shelby, like it starts with giving more people that opportunity and getting people to know about it. Let's start even talking about these issues, because climate change hasn't been talked about. Mm-hmm. We had a goal in 2018 to make climate change matter and be a priority. Mm-hmm. This year, and we feel like we've done that with the Green New Deal, and people are starting to talk about it. And once you start talking about it, you can start opening up people to new ideas, new options and stuff. And frankly, that's not a conversation that's really been had in this country yet, so there is going to be a lot of pushback. But as people start to understand the implications of the benefits this can provide and what this can open up to all kinds of people, we're planning to see a shift in public opinion as well. But a lot of people understand that climate change is an issue. A lot of people, the majority of people, want to see something done about it, and we just need to now start talking about what that's actually going to look like.
Starting that conversation is really important, and I think combining that, Green and New Deal. I mean, those are two. I have the suspicion that some people think of it as the Green New Deal, sort of like New Deal in parentheses. But if you read the draft proposal, there's really a lot in there about. About jobs and about social justice and about unions and all of that is part of changing the culture. Like I was talking about, like we can't do things the same way, just like we can't produce power the same way, we can't organize our production or our transportation or our food production the same way if we're going to avert the climate catastrophe that all of our science says that we're headed towards. So I really think that it's important to emphasize it's the Green New Deal, not the Green New Deal. You know, it's a integrated package, and that kind of integration of putting things together that our culture hasn't necessarily put together before is a driver that can change culture. Because the way that culture typically works is people have sort of categories in how they think about things. Like you think about production over here, and you think about the environment over here, and you think about transportation over here, and you think about food and agriculture over here. And by putting these things together, because they have those interconnected systems, that produces a new way of organizing how we think about the world around us, and how we think about ourselves interacting with that world. So I think on a, I think that it has built into it the seeds of that kind of a cultural transformation. But I think that that's the one part that I haven't seen talked about as much that, really, I think that's something that has to be a driver of these ideas in order for that to work through the, that to be processed through our culture in a way that leads to the kind of result that we're looking for. So I really think that that's something that, some group of people need to really take on and think about, you know, how to make those kinds of arguments.
Can I say something about that?
Sure, yeah.
Because, yeah, I actually come from the Thumb of Michigan, very conservative place, very sure. much farm town. And just this past, like, 10 years, I've seen so many wind turbines come up in the area. Mm-hmm. And it's great. We have more jobs now. We are more energy dependent. It's amazing.
Energy independent.
We're energy independent now. Mm-hmm. And just to think of that, like, what that can mean on a national scale and for communities of color and for communities that have been off the grid for so long. This is transformative.
Sure.
This is amazing.
Sure.
And
is that power staying in the area? Because a lot of the times, and I don't know the statistics on it in Michigan, but I know that a lot of the times, farmers, for example, find out that, hey, you know, I can lease this piece of this size bit of my acreage to the wind turbine folks and, you know, get a certain amount of money for it. But they aren't, this, a lot of the time they're not necessarily getting all that much from what I understand. And it's not clear that that energy is staying to be self-sufficient in the area as opposed to being, transmitted, farther away. Which is one of the thing with the smart grids that's specifically mentioned in the draft legislation. So I'm just wondering, do you know how that works at all?
Unfortunately, I don't know. But yeah, I think that's one of the things about the Green New Deal that we're going to have to figure out as we go along. It's definitely not going to be perfect right out the bat. Mm-hmm. But like just seeing the changes that happened in my hometown in my lifetime, it gives me a lot of hope. And if there's people from everywhere at the table having this discussion, I think we can come up with a just way of satisfying everyone.
Okay. So, what are the kinds of organizing activities that you guys are doing right now, in your communities, you know, to promote this and other kind of political stuff?
Yeah, great question. So, one thing we did a few weeks ago before the election is we had our first federal jobs guarantee panel, because that's a facet of what the Green New Deal is trying to promote. Just brought in some speakers and had close to 100 people fill up the room to start that conversation and get people involved with that. Mm-hmm. But what we're really working on right now is continuing the pressure on Congress. And so we're like getting our classmates, our fellow neighbors and whatnot, our family to reach out to our representatives and say, like, we need your support on this. This is something we support you to support as well. And then just the other day, we announced that we're going to have another action in D.C. on December 10th to really just mobilize as many young people across this country to show up, put our bodies online, and let Congress know this is not something we're just like, I'm going to let go away. This is something we believe in. This is something we need, and this is something we need them to support. So really, we're just trying to get as much support and raise as many people's voices up as we can from our communities, whether it's in D.C. or back home, just to let them know they do have a voice and the representatives need to hear it.
So one of the things that's going to matter to them in that area is like how successful you've been. And you mentioned the five states that you guys particularly targeted with candidates that were that prioritized climate change and took the no fossil fuel pledge. So how successful was that in those five states? How much impact were you able to have there?
Yeah, great question. So with the incoming Congress, about a third of the new Congress has taken the no fossil fuel money pledge. So that is not an insignificant number.
Like, so a third of the new Congress, are you talking House and Senate?
House, yeah, sorry.
A third of the new House
coming in, okay. Took the no fossil fuel money pledge.
Okay, so so over 100 people, so over 100 representatives. Or are you talking about a third of the new people that are coming in?
The new people, yeah.
Not the new Congress, the new people in Congress, the new people in the House.
Yeah, thanks for the clarification. Okay. Yes, that's what it meant.
All right. Yeah. And do you know what that number? I don't know how many new people that, you know, I don't know that number.
For some reason, I want to say like around 36, 37 is the number of people in Congress, the House of Reps, mm-hmm. that took the pledge. Don't quote me on that, but I think around there. So that would make sense. Right. About 100 new people coming in.
Right. I think right now there are currently 15 sponsors in the House as of a day or two ago.
As of today, 18, and it might be even close to 20 now. Okay. Because there's a press conference this morning that 9 representatives held in D.C. just to promote the Green New Deal.
So. I didn't see that. I know I want to give a shout out to Rashida Tlaib, who's a representative here in Michigan, who was one of the 15 already when I read that last night. So great that we have good representation here in Michigan, and I definitely want to. I will definitely be. Contacting my congressperson and letting Debbie Dingell know that she needs to be on board with this Green New Deal for sure.
Thank you.
Oh, and let's see here. What do we got? The new freshman members of Congress, 101 new elected representatives. So a third, you know, in the 30s there. That's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's really awesome. So I want to come back to the question about funding, because I think this is a critical piece of it, and where we're going to run up. I think we're running up against some very powerful forces that we can identify pretty directly that we're going to have issues with in terms of funding and more generally the idea of moving away from fossil fuels. Before I get into that, did you have anything?
We've been talking a little bit about like the logistics of how we'd imagine this plan would work. But to my understanding, does this plan actually have any like logistics laid out for it already, as far as what the actual New Deal would look like enacted in the United States?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's the main task of what the committee would do in the next 2 years, is coming out with the details, because part of the beauty of it is that it leaves a lot of this up to the local governments to how it would be implemented in their area and the local communities based on their needs. So a lot of those details
It doesn't actually require that the plan do that. So it could do that. That was another question that I had, though, because I fully believe that the people behind it want it to turn out that way, but there's not a guarantee that it'll turn out that way. So we have to monitor that. I mean, as much as we're behind people like Ocasio-Cortez or Rashida Tlaib or other people that we really feel have our backs on this, we still have to hold their feet to the fire, not necessarily because they might have a difference of change of heart in that area. I'm not suggesting that, but because the massive pressure that's going to be brought to benefit some and not others, and that often comes by taking power away from local communities to have a say in some of those areas. So we have to watch for that. But I'm sorry. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah. So I just want to clarify that seems like if there's any kind of political discourse about whether or not to enact this kind of idea, it's not about what we should be doing. It's about just coming up with the plan in order to do it in the first place, right? Is that understanding correct? That we're talking about, should we have a plan to deal with climate change within 10 years? We're not saying what the plan is. We're saying there should be a plan in place.
What we're saying is there, you're right, there is not a plan right now to transition our economy and address the scale of this crisis that we need. And so this is that first step, is to create a plan and then ideally implement it as effectively as we can, realizing a bunch of hiccups are going to come up along the way with pushback. But we have 12 years, we know, to significantly tackle climate change, and this is a plan to address that.
So why would somebody be against making a plan to address one of these major crises that our country is facing right now?
Yeah, so great question. Some of the pushback we're seeing from some Democrats in Congress already is like, there's already a couple climate change related committees, and they say that's enough. But our answer to that is like, if it's been enough, we would have more done in this country at this point. And the committee that Nancy Pelosi wants to reinstate, it doesn't have the jurisdiction to create legislation and implement it. And so we believe we need a whole new committee with Democrats leading it that aren't taking fossil fuel money, ideally Republicans too, that would get behind it, and that can enact legislation and have some real power and teeth behind it.
Let me answer that question really concisely. The reason that people will be against making a plan is because if there's a plan, it's more likely to actually be implemented.
That's the obvious answer right there.
Let's just be clear. That's what's going on here. And part of the reason for that ties into what I mentioned before about some of the forces that we're really going to be fighting with, is there are an awful lot of people that have an awful lot of money on paper, that's dependent on extracting a whole bunch more fossil fuels that are right now still in the ground. A lot of the valuation of fossil fuel companies is based on the amount of fuel that they lay claim to that they have not yet extracted. So one of the things that we're fighting is the idea that people get to make money however they want to. We've already agreed a long time ago that people are not supposed to make money by, for example, robbing you at gunpoint. A while ago we supposedly had an agreement. It's kind of like fittered away a bit, quite a lot. We had an agreement that you're not supposed to make money by controlling all of one industry so you can set the prices without competition. We used to have anti-monopoly laws. We broke up the big telephone companies, for example, many decades ago. So there are definitely ways that we've agreed that you're not supposed to make money. And now we have to come to an agreement that you don't get to make money by poisoning the planet, and raising everybody's, temperature. In that way. And that kind of a shift in the ways in which you're allowed to make money, is going to be resisted by all of those people who make a lot of money that way. So I think that's why you need people that are not, getting donations from the fossil fuel industry, on that committee, and why a lot of those other committees that have people like that sprinkled all through them, some of them saturated, those aren't effective. And we've seen that actually the objection that you just mentioned, it is so clearly refuted in the on the page of, with the draft legislation on Ocasio-Cortez's website. There's a section right under the draft legislation. I recommend anybody listening to this, go and read it. Those objections are so bogus. It's just, it's like up is down and left is right and black is white and all of that kind of stuff. It's ridiculously unsustainable the way that it's been. Yeah. So I'm sorry, did you have someone?
No, that covers it. I think it's fascinating that we can't even agree that there's a problem, it seems, in this country, that there should be this agreement, because there's all this agreement among the professionals that this is a problem that we need to address, and we need to come together and address it. And we're at the point where we're trying to, in essence, debate whether or not we should be even creating a plan in order to address this thing that we know is a problem. And that boggles my mind. If you went back to when I was in elementary school and told me that that's what we did, that'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what makes the Green New Deal so important. We have to completely change this narrative that you have to choose between fixing the environment and creating jobs for people. Like, those two things should not be separate. We should be able to do them both at the same time, and this is how we can change that narrative.
There's a completely false dichotomy between the two things.
Yeah. Well, we can totally create jobs. It's just they're going to be jobs that are going to give money to people that aren't the people that right now have money.
Yep. Precisely.
I mean, that's one big issue with it. I really think a lot of it is going to come down to the funding idea. And this is the two biggest, pushbacks, I think, are the fossil fuel industry for the reasons that we just discussed. And the other one is the funding issue, which is actually also a bogus issue. But there's another paradigm shift there. We're talking about a paradigm shift in our manufacturing, in our transportation, in our agriculture, in our, how we live at home, all of those things going away from carbon fuels and moving towards renewables. That's a huge paradigm shift in the technology of our culture and the technology that we use and that we decide is acceptable to use. There's some technologies we've decided are not acceptable to use, in other areas. And there's also a paradigm shift coming in terms of how we go about paying for things as a society. Have you guys talked about that much? Is Sunrise working on any of that stuff? Like, for example, with people doing modern monetary theory or other ways of understanding the difference between how we've done economics for a long time that's really rooted in feudalism and the gold standard that evolved from that. And looking at the reality of how the economy actually works today, and understanding how to manage it on the basis of a scientific or engineering analysis of how it really works, as opposed to how we developed a way of thinking about it over hundreds of years of it working completely differently, whether it's the gold standard or earlier based on land and agriculture, et cetera.
Yeah, so Shelby and I, that's not the work we've been doing with our group. We've been doing a lot of just like community work and getting out the vote, especially up the election. Okay. So yeah, our the team that's been working on this policy and this proposal, they have been looking into those details. Unfortunately, we're not the policy on the team with that information. But yeah, that's definitely something they've been looking into.
Okay. So let me ask you more about that. In terms of your organizing, what are you finding in terms of when you're talking one-on-one with people, what's the pushback that you get from people in a one-on-one situation?
I haven't received any pushback whatsoever.
Really?
People are really excited about this. This is literally going to change the course of history. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people from like different activist spheres reach out to me and like, they want to know more about this. They sense that the future is changing and they want to be a part of it. And they want to have their say, and it's amazing.
Okay. So you were saying that a lot of it in the conception of it, a lot of this is going to be driven also from the local level. So are you doing organizing with people about, you know, talking to their local politicians, city, county, regional, like water authorities, things like that, and state government?
Yeah, so right now, because we're in a very severe time crunch, we're trying to get as much support for the House of Congress as we can before they break on December 13th or 14th for the year, because that's when they're going to set the rules for next year and everything. So that's been our main focus right now. But yeah, our strategy for 2019 is to have this conversation at every level of government, at like community leaders in the area, just to get everyone on the same page. But yeah, right now, with the time crunch we have, we've just been really focusing on getting the U.S. House involved.
So the key thing is to get this select committee approved in the House so that this project can go forward, because the project right now is really that select committee in the House getting all the pieces together and coming up with the draft legislation in time to implement it. And one of the key things it says in there is that what the plan that they come up with is something that should be that is designed to be executed within 10 years of the start date, when that plan should that plan pass Congress and be signed by the president.
Ideally the draft legislation will drop in Congress January 1st, 2020 or January 3rd, whenever they come back in session in 2020 and start getting the votes behind it. So
I understand right now focusing on getting that select committee. What are the things that people listening can do right now over the next couple of weeks that we have to get that into the new rules for the new Congress? What are the things that people need to be doing to make that happen?
We need to get our representatives to support this. We need to blow up their phones. We need to send them letters. We need every representative we can get on our side on this.
And so that can look like a various ways, like Shelby mentioned, like making phone calls. We've been having letter to the editors pushes all around the country. We had two letters to the editor published in this recent publication, the Lancet State Journal, about the Green New Deal. But also December 4th, this upcoming Tuesday, we're going to have a social media blast with coordinating all across the country just to get hashtag Green New Deal going as we target representatives that's still been on the fence and just like to show this support, continue the conversation going. So anyone with a social media account, they can be part of that on Tuesday, December 4th. And then, again, on December 10th, we're going to be meeting in D.C. We're going to be close to 500 strong, just showing up in the halls of Congress, targeting representatives that are against this. And whether you can be there or not, You can take action at home. You can like call your representatives that day. You can donate to Sunrise to help us fund more people to get there so we can cover travel costs. You can like just pressure local groups to sign on to the resolution. Right now, as of this morning, we had 108 organizations across the country sign on in support of the resolution. So if you're part of an organization or you have leverage there, you can ask your group to sign on to the resolution as well. Because basically, as many ways as we can show support for this, which we know is out there, the better we're going to be to make this pass.
So when you say organizations, for example, like city councils or county commissions, is that as well, not just citizen group, just grassroots organizations, but also actually municipal organizations and people in government already?
Yeah, great question. We've been mostly just doing citizen and grassroots organizations, but yeah, definitely if they're like a chamber of commerce or like some other like government affiliated or whatnot group wants to sign on, that is what we're looking for. So, okay.
So that might be an interesting push for some local organizations to do to hit up their local city councils, county commissions, watershed management, regional watershed management folks that may already, for one reason or another, be inclined, and not that you should only go after people that be inclined. I'm talking about because of the timeline.
Yeah.
If you can get some people in government to do that, that's actually that's something that a lot of people in Washington will pay a little bit more attention to, it seems to me. It shouldn't be that way. It should be, but that's what happens as I've seen it. Say again, what is this? On December 10th, there's an action in D.C. What was the December 4th thing that you mentioned? I want to clarify that.
Yeah, great. Thank you for asking. Yeah, so December 4th, just to continue building momentum and like highlighting that there is going to be this action on December 10th. People are just going to take to the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and whatnot, and just like talk about the Green Deal, talk about why they want to support, calling out their representatives that haven't signed it yet, thanking their representatives that have and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be, you can see all of the details and like sample tweets and whatnot on Sunrise's website, sunrisemovement.org. You can check it out there.
Sunrise Movement, all one word,
yep.
.org.
.org, okay. Yep, thank you. And so we're just going to be blowing up social media to just get hashtag Green New Deal trending and just like pressure as many more people as we can. So.
Okay. Very, very cool. So do you know like what your numbers are? Like, do you have stats across the country? How many people are mobilizing with Sunrise? I mean, or are doing the kind of organizing work that you guys are doing, and what kind of contact rates and that kind of stuff that you guys have had so far?
Yeah, another great question. And this has been something we've been growing on significantly the last 3 weeks, because after action, the week after election, we've been growing with people reaching out to us like, I want to get involved, I want to do something. Mm-hmm. So the past year, we more or less had like a managing team of 20 people or so with 70 full-time fellows across the country, mm-hmm. dedicating their time to this. And since then, we've really grown. Like the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, we had distributed actions where people that, like, if they wanted to have an action in the representative office, they would have it. There was over 150 of those around the country, which is volunteers just standing up and taking charge of it. Mm-hmm. And so the short answer is, it's hard to track everyone we have. It's growing every day. We're having more and more people jump on. This past Tuesday, we had a call to tell people how they can evolve. Mm-hmm. We had over 430 people on that call. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, we had a call for people to start up hubs. They had close to 150 people on that call to start up hubs, mm-hmm. in their areas so they can get more and more people. Mm-hmm. So we have a very distributed network. And so we're working on those systems to track it all. But all we know is growing, and people are standing up and taking charge, which is great.
Cool. How about here in Michigan? How many people are doing stuff, and what kind of stuff? What kind of results have you gotten so far?
Yeah. In Michigan, we throughout the year, we had a team here in Lansing, a team out in Kalamazoo with about 5 to 6 full-time people in both locations. But yeah, like yesterday, we had a meeting where 25 people showed up to at MSU's campus about wanting to get more involved. And we know we have people all around the state. We have a listserv of like, I think close to 1,500 people now that take various actions online and stuff. But we're really seeing this grow in Michigan as well. Like one example of we can point to the work we're doing is that we're doing a lot of get out the vote efforts at MSU along with NextGen, who's mm-hmm. all over the country. They're a great
sure.
group. But
we had the NextGen, one of the big NextGen organizers from U of M, Hudson Villanueva, was here a couple of weeks ago. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they came out with stats on campuses all over the country, like how voter turnout was compared to 2014, and all of them improved where they were. But where we were as well with them working at MSU, voter turnout more than quadrupled at MSU, and so that's part of the work we were doing.
Okay.
And yeah, so we're starting to get a presence and we're going to keep on growing. And that's one thing we're really going to build in 2019 is rebuild our army, have trainings and mass mobilization events all around the country, especially here in Michigan, because we have so much momentum going here.
So I guess the big question is, I mean, I really think it's critical to get this select committee because it's about, you know, we have to have a plan because if we don't have a plan, we're not going to solve the problem. So that actually, that really has to happen, but that's no guarantee that it will. So, in case that doesn't happen, what's the plan?
Yeah, great question. And we do have a plan because it's a very real option that this committee might not get created. And so I don't know the exact details of it.
Let me just say, I wouldn't call it an option. I'd call it a disaster. But I understand.
Yeah, for sure. We're definitely pushing as hard as we can to make this happen. Plan B is to create a ghost committee, essentially, because we know there's so much support behind this, so many people that want to get involved. We'll just create our own little group on the side of representatives like Ocasio and Rashida Tlaib that are already championing this, have them do what they can on the side, get those experts that would be invited anyway to start drafting this legislation, have that created on the side. So ideally, next election, 2020, there'll still be something there. It won't be able to be introduced by the committee and stuff. We'll have to go through some various means. But we can't wait for the next round of Congress to get this going if it doesn't happen. So we're going to take it upon ourselves and with people that are willing to support us to get it going anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any actions coming up specifically here in Michigan or in the Lansing area?
There will be, on December 10th, the details are still up in the air, especially it's a little harder here because Alyssa Slatkin has yet to have an office. But there will be something here in Michigan. The details are being worked out.
Okay. Has Alyssa Slatkin signed on to this yet or not?
Not yet.
Have there been discussions?
Been reaching out to her on social media. The problem is she hasn't established an office in Lansing yet, but once she does, you can bet everything you got that we're going to be there asking her to sign this.
And you know, it'd be really nice to see members of Congress that are interested in this reaching out to their constituents who are making this kind of effort, because that really shows that there's grassroots support for this across the country. Particularly, they can look in their own jurisdictions and find that there's a lot of people doing this. So I would encourage Alyssa Slatkin and Haley Stevens and all of the rest of the Democratic and Republican. I don't think this should be a partisan issue. Members of Congress here in Michigan, across the country, get in touch with the Sunrise Movement and find out about what it is and make a decision one way or another and tell us why. Because we get to vote and we're going to be voting on whether or not the current representatives support saving the planet from climate catastrophe. And if that's not something that they're into, they don't belong in government.
Yeah, precisely. And Andrew just shared with me that tomorrow, December 1st, there's going to be an event from 4 to 7, the Brighton Lions Community Den that Alyssa Slatkin is going to be in attendance at. So we might try to send someone there, but if anyone is there and wants to ask her about the Green New Deal, that's great. We just need to ask her where she's at. So
Awesome. Anything else we didn't cover yet that you guys want to talk about regarding the Green New Deal or stuff that Sunrise is doing or other activism that you guys are involved in? Any of the three of you?
Another thing, like a big thing we were doing all year was talking about the Line 5 pipeline and how we need to shut that down. And as people are aware right now, there's a lame duck session going on where they're trying to get this tunnel passed, ram it down our throats before we can really get the new administration in there. Right. So on Monday, we're going to have an action in partnership with We the People, who has started here in Michigan and other places, to show up at the Chamber of Commerce to really demand that we don't want this tunnel. Listen to the people of Michigan that voted for candidates that didn't want this tunnel, that overwhelmingly are concerned about having this pipeline there. So that's another thing we're doing is really getting this pipeline shut down in conjunction with fighting for the minimum wage and the paid sick leave that's also on the cutting block with this current lame duck session. So we're showing support for that as well.
And let's get clear about what this lame duck session is doing. What it's trying to do Republicans in the state legislature and the governor's mansion, Snyder's a part of this, saying we don't like the result of the last election, so we're going to try to change the rules after the election to prevent the will of the people from having the power of government. I mean, that's really what they're doing. They're trying to limit the amount of control that people have over their own government. I just get really exercised about people who claim to believe in the Constitution, but have no desire to actually enact democracy. It's one of those things that anybody who believes in democracy, looking at what they're doing in the lame duck session, I don't understand. I mean, I understand, but it means that you can't really support democracy if you support these people. They don't want the people to have a say in their government. You know, it's also the initiative for One Fair Wage that they're trying to gut, paid sick leave that they're trying to gut, all of these things that people want. And even some of these people voted for to take the vote away from the citizens so that they could come back and change it. It's just disgusting.
To say the least, yeah.
Andrew, you had something on
there? So I think it's interesting that climate change is an issue that's going to take a long time to address. And even this really ambitious plan, we're looking at a 10-year window. And that's outside the span of a lot of people that might be term limited, who are in from local politics all the way up to Congress. Mm-hmm. So how is this plan going to look with people changing seats, you know, all the way through this way, that we have to enact this plan with people changing, leaving and going, and it still has to work. It still has to come together. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the more that we do this work and the more that young people show up to these elections, the more progressive our House members become and the more likely we are to get even more action done on this proposal. We just have to keep our fire going. We have to keep demanding that our politicians be better and that they represent us.
I think Shelby's right, and what that says, sort of from a broader view is that we know that the demographics are on our side on this. We know that the vast majority of millennials and younger than millennials are in favor of changes to our technology system, our installed capacities, and all of that, away from fossil fuels to renewables, and you know, because of the climate change issue, and they're also much more what we would typically call liberal in terms of social justice and in terms of racial equality and gender equality and all of those things that have typically been the wedge issues of the Republicans and conservatives. So I think that people talked about the blue wave this time, and I think it's really short-sighted to look at it as just one election. You know, we've got an ocean that we've got to actually cool down because it's too hot right now. So yeah. We need a lot more waves coming up on shore.
We could literally lose all coral reefs.
Yeah.
With climate change, worst case scenario.
That's a time scale of about 150 to 100 years, I think I've heard some scientists say. Yeah. Yeah. So people may not think, well, you know, people go and snorkel off coral reefs. What's the big deal? But can you tell us a little bit about why that's important? Because that's more important.
It's a biodiversity hotspot that's been around for a very, very long time. And not only you're losing tourism, but you're also losing biodiversity. You're losing stability of that ecosystem. If you're looking for direct connections to the economy, ecotourism and just morality of losing that many species, a sheer number. Fisheries, the ability to go outside and fish are going to be affected by losing all these organisms. And coral reefs are cool. There are entire marine biologists, like there's an entire study of people that study just coral reefs. And people get saltwater aquariums that have coral reefs in them, and we could lose them.
Yeah, yeah. I've actually done a lot of swimming and diving off of coral reefs, and they're really, really awesome. And I would say I recommend people go, but right now, really, we need the people not to go. We need people to appreciate from afar so that we can let them rebuild. let them regrow. I shouldn't say rebuild. Yeah. So, are you guys students at MSU? Is that
I am. Yeah, I'm currently a student at MSU. Mm-hmm. I also run the MSU hub for Sunrise there.
Okay. Cool. What does a hub do? What's a hub versus there were a couple of different names that you used. How's that set up?
Yeah, well, since it's a nationwide movement, it helps that we have concentrated areas of people who are willing to really show up and do the work. So there's one in Lansing, there's one at LCC, there's one at MSU, there's one in Kalamazoo College, one at Western. And this way, like, we can individualize, like, our approaches, but at the same time work as a whole national movement.
Okay, so do you have, facilities and resources someplace, like, you know, computers and stuff like that, or it's just where you organize? It's not an infrastructure place at all.
Well, we lived in a movement house in Lansing here this summer, but...
Oh, cool. Oh, you know what? I think I met somebody who said that they were at the movement house, at a rally somewhere. Yeah, I remember about that. So that, and that's pretty cool. You live in that kind of change of culture is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I mean, communal houses are things that have been around for thousands of years. And certainly on the left side of the spectrum in America, there have been communal houses for quite a long time. But around a single issue like that, or it's not really a single issue, but around an idea like that is pretty cool. Was that unique to Lansing, or were there a lot of those around the country?
Nope, they're all over the country.
Consciously, the Sunrise Movement decided that this was an important thing to do, to have houses like that. That's really awesome. That's the kind of cultural thinking that I was talking about before that I think is really important, to have those kinds of living situations that are different than the norm, that open people up to being more connected. And I mean, obviously in college you have the dorms and stuff like that, but it's a very different ethos.
Yeah, yeah. At the end of the day, we're community organizers because we already see climate change is hitting us hard today. And even if everything goes as well as we want with this Green New Deal, we're still going to be facing a lot in the upcoming decades that we're going to have to face. And we borrow something from the Obama campaigns, but we're metrics driven, but people focused, because that's what it comes down to. We need to create these relationships within ourselves as coworkers and colleagues, and within the community we're working in. So yeah, living in a movement house, like just showing that camaraderie and whatnot, and like having a meeting space for people to come and literally feel at home is a big part of that. But then also, yeah, I'm just like reaching out to our neighbors, living in the community we're working with, and just being able to help create that culture shift just by really building the relationships with people, because we need communities looking out for one another more to go through what's going to come.
Right. Right. That's, there's a lot of studies that show friendships, especially friendships that are deeper, where you can like talk to people about stuff that might be uncomfortable. Those things develop when you have, spaces where people can, where people run into each other serendipitously, not by planning, not like, okay, we're going to have a meeting and everybody show up to the meeting and do the thing, but where you are naturally in an environment where people interact with each other just because they happen to end up at the same place at the same time. And that might seem the way that I described it now is to just be kind of like, whatever, but actually a lot of cultural processing happens in those kinds of environments in ways that it doesn't happen in other kinds of environments where you're task focused as opposed to relationship focused. So that's, the fact that there are hundreds of those, I did not know this. I'd heard about the one in Lansing, but I didn't know that was a policy across the country, or not necessarily a policy, but a promoted idea.
Yeah. And so just to clarify a little bit, yeah, so not every single hub has a movement house. There were like nine, I believe, this past time around, and we're going to have two, potentially four for 2019, and then we'll expand that hopefully to like 20 or 30 come 2020 when we revamp, get out the vote efforts, but yeah.
That's really, really exciting, because that kind of thing is the way that you build a larger and larger core of people who have a different idea about how to live with other people in the world. And that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to do. I'm not saying that everybody's going to have to live in a communal house. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that I am saying that, I am saying that the kind of social interaction that you get there develops interconnections that are different than you can get in an environment where you can't just, you know, regularly have serendipitous interactions, regular serendipitous interactions, but not with the same people necessarily, but with a wider group. I'm going to go a little bit abstract here, but if you think, you can think about a culture as a group of people that process information together. And when you don't have those serendipitous interactions like that, there's much less information processing that goes on. And there's an awful lot of information that we need to process as a culture in order to be able to implement the kind of changes that you're talking about. And developing the culture's ability to process that information at a deeper level and more efficiently is the kind of thing that you're going to have houses like you were talking about, and other kinds of social organizations that are going to be not just task focused. Because when you're task focused, you're often cut off from building deeper relationships that go beyond that task. And the integration of all of these things, just like we talk about in the Congress, we need the select committee because everything else is broken up between all of these different committees. That's the same thing that happens across the progressive movement when you have this group focused on this piece and this group focused on this piece and this group focused on this piece. And sometimes you have people that are, a lot of time you have people that are in a bunch of different ones. But when you go to a meeting, you talk about the one that you're at the meeting for. And you might do a little bit of the other stuff. But that's very, very slow kind of cultural processing. Faster than what without it, but the kind of thing that you guys are talking about. I can't overemphasize how deeply important that is, even though some people may see it as a side thing. Anyway, I'm sorry. The cultural thing is one of my big things, and that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. This work is much more beyond any one candidate, any one campaign, any one election cycle. We're in this for the long haul. And like you said, we got to build those relationships. So that's a thing I'm very grateful for with this group, is that it's a priority for us. So.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Shelby and Nicholas from the Sunrise Movement here in Lansing, and Andrew, a local environmental activist. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. That's all for this episode. If you don't already, you can help support this show on Patreon. Your monthly contribution of $5 or more will give you access to bonus content like extended episodes and exclusive one-on-one interviews with special guests. Find us at patreon.com/Michigan Progressive. State of the Revolution is a production of Michigan Progressive. Our director and editor is Benjamin Klein. Our producers are Sam Pernick, Mara Zumberg, and Eric Kester. Our music is composed by Benjamin Klein. I'm Leon O'Sharon. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with another episode soon.